This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. If you know the show Fiddler on the Roof, this music will sound familiar, but these lyrics won't. That's music from the Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof, which is now playing off-Broadway. The cast recording will be released later this summer, but we have an advance copy to play for you. My guests are Stephen Skybell, who stars as Tevye, and Joel Grey, who directed this production. Grey is most famous for starring as the MC in the original Broadway cast of Cabaret and in the film adaptation. Fiddler on the Roof is one of the most popular shows in Broadway history and has been performed around the world. It's set in 1905 in a shtetl in Eastern Europe. Shtetl is the Yiddish word for small town or village. At the time Fiddler takes place, many Jews in the Russian Empire were confined to living in the shtetls. Tevye is a dairyman who struggles to support his wife and five daughters. Three of his daughters are old enough to marry, and Tevye and his wife are expecting to follow the tradition of arranged marriages. But the daughters want to marry for love. The show is about the generational conflict between following religious and cultural traditions and adapting to a world that is rapidly changing. Some of the change confronting the family is tragic. The pogroms, Russian attacks on the Jews in the shtetls, have gotten worse, and the Russian Tsar has been ordering the expulsion of Jews in many villages. This revival of Fiddler is a production of the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, which is the longest continuously producing Yiddish theater company in the world. Yiddish used to be the primary language spoken by Jews in Central and Eastern Europe. Fiddler on the Roof is based on stories that were written in Yiddish by Sholem Aleichem. Joel Grey, Stephen Skybell, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this production. It is really, really wonderful. So, Joel, what's the backstory of the Yiddish version of Fiddler on the Roof that you're using? Who wrote it? Why did they write it?
Shraga Friedman was an actor and director, and he translated it for himself to play in Israel after it was a big hit on Broadway. And that Yiddish version did not go very well because Israelis, they thought they were modern and reinventing the world, and they were. However,
and Hebrew became the language instead of Yiddish.
And Hebrew was the language that they adopted. And then he did it in Hebrew, and it was a success. And as far as I know, he interpolated certain Yiddishisms into Sheldon Harnick and Joe Stein's work, the original work. But essentially, it's pretty much the same show as we came to know it on Broadway. And I saw maybe eight versions. I have been obsessed with that. And I once thought I wanted to play Tevye, but then I got too old. And then I got a call from Zalman Milotek from the Volksbühne, and he said, I'm doing Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish. Would you like to direct it? And I said, I don't speak Yiddish, and I don't. Unfortunately, I speak Mickey Katz.
your father,
not exactly classical Yiddish. I said, but something inside of me said, you have to do this. It's an affair of the heart.
Well, I want to hear another song from the forthcoming cast recording of the Yiddish production of Fiddler on the Roof. And we're going to hear you, Stephen Skybell, singing one of the famous songs from the show, L'chaim. And I know when I interviewed Sheldon Harnick about writing the lyrics for this show, he said, you know, the characters in this would have been speaking Yiddish. because that's the language that Sholem Aleichem wrote in. But there's only two Yiddish words in the lyrics that Sheldon Harnick wrote. One is mazel tov, as in a blessing on your head, mazel tov, mazel tov. And mazel tov means congratulations. And the other is l'chaim, which is one of the most titles of one of the most famous songs from the show, which means to life, as the lyric tells you.
Mm-hmm,
to
right.
life, to life, l'chaim. So before we hear this, do you want to say anything about doing the song?
Well, I mean, just that it is it's a moment of pure joy in this story, which sometimes has darker corners. And that's an aspect of it that I really relish every night, is that it's alcohol induced, but it is pure joy, and it just shows you that it is what Sunrise Sunset says, that the life is smiles and tears.
So let's hear Stephen Skibel from the forthcoming cast recording of the Yiddish Fiddler on the Roof.
Soll sein zum Guten, verbrochen und hat's lachen, verleben und gesund sein, in a guter und mazeldicker Show. Soll sein mit Glück, lechaim, lechaim, lechaim soll sein. Soll da schon lebendig und freilich sein,
weil wir mehlig sein.
Lechaim soll sein, mit Glück, lechaim. Lechaim, lechaim soll sein. Das Leben ist am Mischmasch, warum?
Brach es und klall es uns.
Lechaim soll sein. So macht aber Chagecho, steht bei uns ein Possig, freien wir sich doch.
Besser statt zu sagen Echo, macht man sich ein Simche, will man Simches noch.
So sein mit Glück, Lechaim, Lechaim, mein Tochter,
mein Weib. Das ist ein Sippe, ein Trag so toll,
Hippe, ein Schnapp so toll. Lechaim.
So it's Stephen Skibel and Bruce Sabbath, who plays Laser Wolf, from the forthcoming Yiddish version of Fiddler on the Roof. Any lyric changes you want to point out to us in the translation?
Yes, it's just let it be to life is what it's saying, as opposed to life, to life, to life. So... because then it would really be l'chaim, 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 l'chaim.
That's too many ch's.
Nobody wants that.
I'm glad you mentioned the ch, because I think some people have trouble saying ch, and you can't speak Yiddish without a lot of ch in it.
That's correct.
Or so, a little, or at least a little ch.
No, but I will say, when I studied with, and her name is Chana Fagel Turteltaub, and she's the Northwestern Yiddish teacher who I went to her home. She was like, ha, ha, ha. That it actually is an identifying aspect of what Yiddish is, and you don't want to be afraid of it. And even when they were coaching us for Fiddler, they just said more of that, because it really is what it is to speak Yiddish, is to get involved with that guttural cleansing.
So, Joel Gray, when you were doing the auditions, did you have to make sure that the people auditioning could do a good chuh?
I know a chuh when I hear it.
All right, so the story of Fiddler on the Roof really resonates today, because it's a story about having to flee and going to other places, because different characters, some characters go to America, one's setting out for Israel, another's going, I think, to Warsaw. Mm-hmm. And no one really knows what they're in store for. We know some of them are likely to die in the Holocaust. Of course, they don't know that. And now, when immigration is such a contentious issue in the U.S., and when so many people from different countries are trying to come here, fleeing from death threats and gangs and hunger, violence, starvation, any number of reasons, trying to come here.
Not exactly different from what it was then.
So it has so much. It has so much resonance now, and it's not, it's a story about Jewish people, but so many Americans who are immigrants come from their version of that story. So I'd like you each to say a few words about why the story feels relevant to you, living today in the climate that we're in.
Well, I'll start by saying, I don't know if you're aware, but just recently we had World Refugee Day, and we actually, the entire theater was filled not with paying audience, but with people who identify themselves as refugees or immigrants. And so there was a whole talk back afterwards that made it very clear that no matter if they're trying to go back home to Venezuela or coming from Venezuela, any corner of the world, there's an aspect of our story which speaks to that flight of people. I'll say for myself personally, when I first experienced Fiddler, I did, as a child, I saw it as a sort of happy ending, because the message for me was, Tevye, you're going to America and you're going to become my grandfather, and it's going to be, you're going to have a happy, happy story here. And as of course, as I've grown up, I realized that's not the ending of Fiddler, and it is a much more ambivalent statement, which is, we don't know where we're going and we don't know what will happen to us, but the hope of Fiddler on the Roof is the final gesture of Tevye, which he nods to the fiddler and says, I don't know where I'm going, but I know I want you to come with me. Whatever this emblem of tradition, Jewishness, God, or shtetl life is, the fiddler, he finally says, come with me. And that is the only hope. That's really the only hopeful movement of the final movements of the musical, is to say, we're in this together. I'm not going to deny you, even if that's the reason why I'm being thrown out.
Joel Grey, to you, what this story means to you now, living in America in 2019?
Seeing the show and feeling the characters' loss and sadness and pluck and spirit every night. And then I come home and I turn on the television and I see these migrants and these kids in cages, and I'm thinking, it's all the same. It's too terrible. And how can we keep doing this? And what's the answer?
I'd like to hear a little bit about your family stories, to the extent that you know it, of how and when they came to the United States.
My grandparents came separately and met in Cleveland, Ohio. And I said to my grandmother, who never really learned to speak English very well, I said, what year was it that you came? She says, was given a grace schnee. She said, there was a big snow. That's how she remembered, and she came by herself on a boat. And you think, how hard was that? How scary. And then they found each other in, she came to be with her cousin, and she met my grandpa. And they had five daughters, and America, they found America, and they were safe. They weren't killed.
And then your father, Mickey Katz, he spoke Yiddish and English, and he was a performer. He sang with Spike Jonze's band, and then he started his own band and sang song parodies that were part English, part Yiddish. And you
born
sang
in
with
the
him.
Wilds of Delancey Street, home of gefilte fish and kosher meat. Handy with the knife, oh, Herzachzi. He flicked him a chicken when he was only three. David, David Crockett. So he took the most American hero and made him Yiddish.
That was the theme for the Davy Crockett TV show.
Right.
But he did the Yiddish parody version. So
right.
So your father knew Yiddish, and you sang with him, so you could sing Yiddish, but apparently you didn't necessarily know what the words meant.
No, I didn't know what I was talking about much, mm-hmm. but I certainly couldn't speak it.
Right.
Unfortunately, I wish I had.
Mm-hmm. Never too late.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here I am.
Right.
You know, I'm in the middle of it.
So, Stephen, what do you know about how your family came to the U.S., and where did they
come
from?
Yes, my father's father came from a small town in northeast Poland called Suwalki. And it was before the First World War. It was all of his brothers came over one at a time to avoid conscription into the army. They were just apparently pulling
into
boys
the Tsarist
off the street.
Army.
That's right. And so my grandfather came over when he was 16. And again, it's like, I cannot even imagine getting on a boat when you're 16 and going. You know, maybe he thought it was a bit of an adventure, but it has to have been more than that. Anyway, he met my grandmother, who lived in Chickasha, Oklahoma. She had a kosher. She was the daughter of sort of the town's elected rabbi. He really wasn't a rabbi, but everybody went to him for decision making, and they kept kosher in Chickasha, Oklahoma. And she somehow met my grandfather. And when my great grandfather, her father, met my grandfather, he didn't believe that he was Jewish because he didn't have a beard, and so he shoved a Yiddish newspaper in his face and said, "Read that to me." And my grandfather did, and thankfully he did, because that's why I'm here. My mother's side of the family was a little more city-dwelling, from Warsaw, Poland, and so they came to Chicago. And I don't know much more about that, except I do know that some of my father's father's family, my aunt and uncle Sidney and Regina, did not come over early, and they ended up in a work camp in Siberia, and then they came later. And so, and their children actually saw our Fiddler on the Roof, and I was very touched that they came and saw it. But they were the closest to the Holocaust for me. But it was a success story in that they made it over.
One of the most famous songs from Fiddler on the Roof is Sunrise Sunset, which is a song that has been sung at countless Jewish weddings for generations. And I told Sheldon Harnick this. I really so strongly disliked the song for so many years, because my parents were among the parents who played the cast album over and over and over. And there were songs that just sounded so like schmaltzy to me. And then when I started to really understand more about music, and about lyric writing, and about Bach and Harnick, the composers of the score, and how great and varied their shows
deep.
Were. And meaningful. I realized, like, what a beautiful song that is. And there's, like, jazz versions of the song, you know, like instrumental jazz versions.
Right.
So I want to play the Yiddish version from the show. And again, Stephen, I'm going to ask you for what you thought about when you were recording this.
Well, I mean, the thing that's interesting to me is that it's about the wedding, Zeitel's wedding, but they chose to let it be voiced through the parents, and it's about the passage of time. Is that the little girl? That's the little girl? How did time pass like that? And to me, that's just so beautiful that should be the musicalized moment, is that life fleets by. And the children become the adults, and it's just laced with laughter and tears. And so, I mean, that is not musical theater. You don't recognize that kind of utterance as a musical theater utterance, but it is very meaningful.
And so much about loss.
Yeah.
Stephen, I'm going to ask you to sing a few of the lines in English for people who don't know the English version of the song, and then we'll hear you in Yiddish.
Well, is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play? I don't remember growing older. When did they?
Beautiful. Let's hear the Yiddish version. And the actress who plays your wife in it is singing with you. And
Jennifer Babiak.
Yeah. So here we go.
Is das mein Mädele, das Kleine? Is es das Jingele, ich sei?
Geht nur und guck, wie schön der wachsen. Sehne, sehne.
Wenn ich sie
azoi schein geworn. Wenn is ois gewachsen heuch?
Erst nachten haben sie gespielt in Haif.
Tor ein Torus, Tor ein Torus, das ist unser Heus.
That was beautiful. Joel Corea, did you give any direction for how you wanted that song to be sung?
Yes. Yes, I wanted it to be spoken, but musically. I wanted it to be about the text, about what they're thinking, what they're feeling in this moment of great joy and yet deep loss.
Thank you both so much, and congratulations on the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Joel Grey directed the off-Broadway production of Fiddler on the Roof, performed in Yiddish. Stephen Skybell stars as Tevye. The cast recording will be released later this summer. The new art house thriller, Midsummer, stars Florence Pugh as a young woman reeling from tragedy when she decides to accompany her boyfriend to a midsummer festival in the Swedish countryside. It's the second feature written and directed by Ari Aster, who made his debut last year with the horror film Hereditary. Film critic Justin Chang has a review of Midsummer.
In the viscerally unnerving films of Ari Aster, there's nothing more horrific than the reality of human grief. His haunted house thriller, Hereditary, followed a family rocked by traumas so devastating that the eventual scenes of devil-worshipping naked boogeymen almost came as a relief. Aster's new movie, Midsummer, doesn't pack quite as terrifying a knockout punch, but it casts its own weirdly hypnotic spell. This is a slow-burning and deeply absorbing piece of filmmaking, full of strikingly beautiful images and driven less by shocks than ideas. It's not interested in frightening you so much as seeping into your nervous system. And like Hereditary, Midsummer is very much rooted in loss. It begins with a young American woman named Dani, played by the great English actress Florence Pugh, panicking over a family emergency that moves swiftly toward its worst possible outcome. As she tries to pick up the broken pieces of her life, Dani seeks solace from her boyfriend, Christian, and is surprised to learn that he's about to go on a trip with some of his grad school buddies. They're headed to a remote Swedish commune that is holding a 9-day festival to observe the summer solstice. Dani presses him about why he didn't tell her earlier, and an argument ensues.
No, you said it would be cool to go.
Yeah, and then I got the opportunity and I decided
Look,
to do it.
Look, I don't mind you going. I just wish you would have told me, that's all.
Well, I just apologize, Dani.
You didn't apologize. You said sorry, which sounds more like too bad.
Maybe I should just go home.
What? No, no. I'm just trying to understand.
And I'm trying to apologize.
And I don't need an apology. I don't. I just wanted to talk about it. That's all.
I really think I should just leave.
No, 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 no. Please, please, please. I'm not trying to attack you.
It
I'm not.
It really feels like you are.
Well, then I'm sorry. I just got confused. I'm sorry. Hey, please, come on. Can you come? Can you come and sit with me, please? Please, and we can talk about it.
The handsome Irish actor Jack Rayner clues you in to the selfishness beneath Christian's quiet, sensitive-sounding demeanor. Dani doesn't know that he was about to end their 4-year relationship before tragedy struck, and he's only staying with her now out of a sense of obligation. Christian reluctantly invites her to join him in Sweden, and she accepts, to the irritation of some of his friends, who don't want his mopey girlfriend along to spoil their fun. They fly to Sweden, and after a few hours' drive, arrive at a remote, centuries-old village where they are greeted by about 60 men and women wearing white robes embroidered with mysterious symbols. They are known as the Harga, and they invite their American guests to participate in each day's festivities, which include lavish feasts, silent meditations, exhausting maypole dances, and the consumption of various mind-altering drugs. Astor has a gift for dreaming up fictitious subcultures, and he visualizes these ancient customs and artifacts with an almost anthropological attention to detail. The Harga seem benevolent enough at first, and there's something comforting about their strange rituals and their intimate communion with nature. But then the mood takes a sinister turn, and Danny and Christian's traveling companions start to disappear. The story owes a clear debt to The Wicker Man, Robin Hardy's 1973 horror classic about a pagan fertility cult. But Midsummer is more ambiguous and slower to come into focus. This is a nightmare that unfolds in broad daylight, under a midnight sun that bears down relentlessly on the landscape. The sun could almost be a metaphor for Danny's grief, something ever-present and all-consuming, especially since Christian seems to take so little interest in consoling her. Astor has said that he was inspired to write Midsummer after the end of a long-term relationship, and that Danny's experience is a fictionalized version of his own. Whatever the real-life details, he's made the ultimate bad boyfriend movie, a withering portrait of emotional neglect that has nothing nice to say about Christian, his petty-minded friends, or indeed the state of contemporary American masculinity. Among other things, Midsummer is a wickedly funny movie about the clash between pagan traditions and the ways of the modern world. One of its more provocative notions is that Danny may in fact be better off with the Harga, with their seemingly selfless, utopian way of life. Sex and death, a source of so much pain and anxiety in the outside world, are here just part of life's unending cycle. Midsummer is in no rush to solve its many mysteries. The third act is full of surreal images of revelry and ritual sacrifice, plus a sex scene that's as hilarious as it is appalling. What you remember most is Florence Pugh's quietly mesmerizing performance. Your sympathies are with Danny at every moment, and so are the movies. Toward the end, she fixes the camera with an extraordinary look of terror and exultation as she beholds the stunning fate that awaits her. Her story may begin in heartbreak and end in madness, but Astor ensures that she gets the last laugh.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, we hear from Tracy Edwards. In 1989, she became the first woman to lead an all-female sailing crew on the Whitbread Round the World race. That grueling voyage is the subject of the new documentary Maiden. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. In the 1980s, the world of open ocean sailboat racing was pretty much all male. That is, until our guest Tracy Edwards decided she'd assemble an all-female crew to enter the grueling and dangerous 33,000-mile Whitbread round-the-world race. As you'll hear, the idea was unthinkable to most of men in the world of yacht racing and the journalists who covered them. The remarkable story of Edwards and her crew is told in a new documentary directed by Alex Holmes titled Maiden, which was also the name of the yacht she sailed in the race. Tracy Edwards had an unhappy childhood after her father died and her mom remarried. She ran away from home as a teenager, made her way to Greece, and fell in love with sailing. She wanted so badly to compete that she signed on as a cook for an all-male crew on a round-the-world race. Though she learned a lot about sailing, she had no luck getting on as a crew member. She talked about her story with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Tracy Edwards, welcome to Fresh Air. So, as I gather from the documentary, you decided you're never going to get accepted as a crew member on a round-the-world race. So you decided, well, you're just going to start your own. How did you pull that off?
Yes, I did look at the world of sailing and thought, I need to change the shape of this because I don't fit in here. And so, you know, my mum always told me, if you don't like the way the world looks, change it. So I thought, okay, I will. I thought the easiest way, that makes me laugh, the easiest way to do that would just be to put an all-female crew together. And, you know, we'll just prove we can do it and everyone will accept it and everything will be fine. But that was far from what happened. You know, we had so much obstruction and criticism and anger, which I found really quite strange. You know, why would you be angry that we want to sail around the world? We're not putting you out, we're just doing our own thing. So it was a strange process. I started out putting an all-female crew together because I wanted to prove that we could do it, but also so that I could be the navigator, which is it's quite a selfish reason. And then as we went on with it and people thought it was so impossible. I thought, well, I've just raced around the world. It's not that difficult.
Right. And, well, you had to figure out, well, you had to buy a boat. And I gather you had a house that you mortgaged, right, and put up and borrowed money. And then you and the women that you recruited worked on restoring this boat yourselves. And it needed a lot of work, right?
Yes, it did. We got to the point where we'd been trying for so long to raise the money, the sponsorship, to design and build our own boat, which, of course, all the other crews were doing. And I realized one day that that's not going to happen. There are times where you do have to admit failure and go in a different direction. This is one of those times. And so we found an old secondhand racing yacht with a pedigree and had been designed and built for Pierre Feldman in the 81-82 Whitbread Round the World race, where she hadn't actually done that well. When we bought her in the summer of 88, I mean, she was in a terrible state, and we put her on a ship and we brought her back to the UK. And then I gave the girls sledgehammers and I said, right, take her apart. And we did. I mean, we stripped the inside of the boat. We stripped the deck. We took the mast out. We took everything apart.
Was it unusual for crew members to do the repairs on their own boat? Is that what the guys did?
It was absolutely unique, completely unique. All these other guys had a shore team. They had brand new boats, so they didn't really need to do any work on them. And you know, so they'd sit in the cafe and watch us as we were putting this boat together. Although, as I say, I mean, there was a very nice part of that, sort of being part of this big Whitbread family, is that if you did go and ask for help, you would 99.9% of the time you would get it. You know, you might get a bit of a snide, well, you know, if you need help kind of thing, but then, you know, we were beggars can't be choosers. But the great thing about doing what we did the way we did it was we learned everything we needed to know about the boat. We put every single item into that boat, onto that boat. We painted her, we put the rig in, we did the rigging, we did the electronics, the plumbing. So when we put Maiden in the water, I would say that us as a crew knew our boat better than any other team in the race.
Which would come in handy later on.
You
got the boat, and even if you fixed it up, you still need a lot of money, because this is a race that takes months and you need shore crews to help. And so you needed a sponsor, and typically corporations would sponsor crews. You couldn't get that. And you got some help as the result of a kind of a chance association you'd made in the past. Tell us about this.
So I know there's bits of my life which are so surreal. I was a stewardess on a charter yacht in Newport, Rhode Island, and we had a very secretive, very important, high-profile guest, and we didn't know who it was.
This is a couple of years earlier, right? Yeah.
This is in 1984.
Okay.
So in 1984, I was working as a stewardess on this charter yacht. We had a surprise guest. It was all a bit weird, actually. We thought it might be Ted Kennedy. But anyway, so we went off to Martha's Vineyard. The whole boat was checked. You know, we had the Navy, we had sniffer dogs, we had divers. Then we weren't allowed to stay on the boat that night. We're like, who is this person? And it turned out to be King Hussein and Queen Noor. And they'd just been to Prince Abdullah's graduation. And they came for a day sailing. And I was washing up after lunch and I felt this sort of presence beside me, and I turned around and it was King Hussein, and he had a tea towel in his hand, and I said, I don't think you can do that. He said, I can do anything, I'm king. I was like, okay. I mean, I didn't really know who he was, if I'm perfectly honest. I was 21 years old, hadn't read a newspaper since I'd left home. But there was something quite extraordinary about this man, and he was fascinated with what I did. And King Hussein was a people collector. And it wasn't just me. I mean, he collected people from all over the world, all walks of life. He found people interesting, fascinating. He loved his fellow human being. And I think that's what made him such an extraordinary leader and why Jordan is such a place of stability in the Middle East today. And he encouraged me to do the 85-86 race. And then when I was putting Maiden together, he was always there in the background, always on the end of a phone if I needed help or advice. But when I got to the point where I thought, I can't spend any more time looking for this money, you know, 2 years, and we had bits and pieces of money and donations and stuff, but no big sponsor. I called him up and I told him, and he went, oh, for goodness sake. He said, right, he said, Royal Jordanian Airlines is going to be your sponsor. And, oh, that was just brilliant. You know, we just having not to struggle for money anymore was amazing. And then, of course, she ended up this beautiful grey colour with the red and the gold stripe, because that's the colour of Royal Jordanian Airlines planes.
Ah. I have to ask, he was always on the other end of a phone. How does one dial up a king? You get a cell phone number?
He left me his phone number before... Well, he left me his phone number before he left the boat. And then before I got home to the UK, he called my mum. And when I did a transatlantic home, and I got to Lymington, and of course we didn't have cell phones in those days, so I went to find a payphone. I called my mother and she said, what have you been up to? I said, nothing. I have literally just got off the boat. I've sailed across the Atlantic. She said, some guy called King Hussein keeps calling. And you know, I said, oh God, please don't tell me you said you're the Queen of Sheba and put the phone down. She said, no, because knowing you, I thought there was every likelihood that it would be. So... So we forged this very strong and very close friendship. And if I ever, ever needed to speak to him, he would always get back to me or be on the end of a phone.
So you get the boat ready and you start going out and sailing and runs. And there was actually a kind of a warm-up race to the round-the-world race. Were you surprised at the media reaction that you got?
We weren't surprised that there was resistance to an all-female crew in the race. You know, sailing is one of the last bastions of patriarchy, if you like. It's, you know, we're a maritime nation. It's entrenched in our history, in our warfare, in our culture, and it is extremely male-dominated. And it was, I would say, the hardest sport of any time, to want to prove that women could do it. So I wasn't surprised there was resistance. The thing that really made me laugh was the two things that guys used to say to us with absolute certainty. One was, you're going to die. Not you might, or, you know, we think it's a bit of a risk, but, you know, you're going to die, which, okay, we took that with a pinch of salt. And the other one, men used to say, is, women don't get on. Well, what? You're not a woman, and you're wrong. And, you know, it was... so weird.
Yeah. One sailing journalist, Bob Fisher, called you a tin full of tarts.
Well, Bob and I are now very good friends. You'll be pleased to hear. Bob was one of the very few journalists who allowed us to change his mind. And when we sailed into New Zealand in first place, Bob Fisher then wrote in Yachts and Yachting, not just a tin full of tarts, a tin full of smart, fast tarts. And we all thought this was great. You know, oh, yay, Bob's changed his mind. And then someone said to us, you do know that tart is still in that sentence. You know, we're like, oh, yeah. Okay, well, maybe a little bit further to go.
One of the things that struck me as I looked at the film, there's a lot of clips of you doing media interviews. And there's one moment, which I'm told you cringe when you see now, where you're asked, are you a feminist? And you say, I hate that word.
Yeah.
What was, I could kind of get what you were saying, but you tell me.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the 80s, feminist was an accusation. It wasn't a nice title. It had all sorts of horrible connotations. And really, it had been made into a word that women should be ashamed of, I think, with deliberate reason. And, you know, I'd drunk the Kool-Aid, basically, and I was very young. I was 23, 24 during that interview. And I didn't want people not to like me. You know, you care very much at that age that people like you. I mean, you may be annoying them and putting this all-female crew together. But I do remember afterwards, my mum said to me, I am so surprised that you don't think you're a feminist. And she said, I'm not going to tell you what you should say. She said, but I think you need to have a bit of a think about that one. And then when we again got to New Zealand and we'd won that leg and we were getting the same stupid, crass, banal questions that we had on every other leg, I just thought, you know what? I think this is bigger than us and bigger than Maiden and bigger than anything we've been tackling. This is about equality. And I think I am a huge fat feminist. I think I absolutely am. And I stood up for the first time in my life and I said something that might hurt me and might make me not likable. And I took pride in it. And it was an extraordinary experience.
When you were working as a cook on the otherwise all-male crew of that round-the-world race back then, when you observed the men on the boat and how they interacted with one another, I'm wondering if that was different from your observations of all women crews that you saw later on.
It's very smelly. It's very messy. You know, there's a lot of swearing. And then there are days when guys don't talk to each other. What is that? So that was very weird. A lot of tension, testosterone, egos. I mean, it was an interesting experience that 9 months. You know, first time and last time I'd ever been, you know, with 17 men and sort of watching them in their environment, if you like, you know, their natural habitat. So it was, I had nothing to compare it to at that time, but then doing an all-female crew, then I noticed, wow, there's a huge difference between a group of women and a group of men.
Right. And how would you describe the difference?
Well, I prefer sailing around the world with an all-female crew. I prefer sailing with women anyway. Much cleaner. You know, we do tend to wash, you know, even if it's in cold salt water. The more use of deodorant as well, I have noticed. But we were always chatting, always talking. I mean, I know people say women talk a lot. We really did, and we did talk the whole way around the world. I don't think there's one subject that we didn't cover in depth, inside, outside, and backwards. Women are kinder to each other in a much more obvious way. So, you know, we're naturally more nurturing and caring, I think. And if you saw someone scared or worried or anxious or a bit down, there'd always be someone, you know, that would put their arm around your shoulder and go, cup of tea? Yes, please. Thank you very much. So just a completely, completely different atmosphere. And I do think that each flourish in their own atmosphere. You see, that's the thing. I have done mixed crews, which have worked really, really well. But I think at that time, it really was each to their own.
This crew, this is not a balmy Caribbean sail. I think one of you said there's nothing that can prepare you for sailing in the Southern Ocean. Can you just describe a little bit about what it was like, what the crew had to put up with?
Okay, so the conditions in the Southern Ocean is your body starts to deteriorate as soon as you cross the start line. Pain and cold are the quickest ways to lose weight. You can get frostbite in your fingers and toes. It's minus 20, minus 30 degrees below freezing. You are constantly damp because salt water doesn't dry. So the girls up on deck would be miserable. Cold, wet, miserable. You know, freezing fingers and toes. Tons of clothing on so you can barely move. The food's revolting, so you just shovel it down your throat as quickly as possible and try and get as much sleep as possible with this four-on, four-off watch system. And it's also a sensory deprivation. There's no sun, there's no blue sky, it's grey, and the boat's grey, and everything's grey, and it is a miserable leg.
And you have to look out for ice, and sometimes it's foggy, and sometimes it's at night. What, do you place someone on the bow? How does that work?
Yep, so you have a bow watch. We realized when we had woken up, well, when I'd woken up and the girls were already staring at it, but I went up on deck and we were sailing past an iceberg and I said, oh my God, I didn't see that on the radar. And they went, nope, we didn't either. So that's when we thought, yeah, we need to have someone up on the bow, just because it just gives you that few seconds more of warning if you see an iceberg and you have to swerve.
You know, we wouldn't have this documentary if there weren't a lot of film taken, or video, I guess, taken on the boat itself. This is real footage done on the voyage in 1989. How did that happen?
Well, the Whitbread organisers wanted some of the boats to take cameras, and most of the guys' boats were far too important and busy to take cameras and film. So, you know, we stuck our hands up and said, we'll film. And so they gave us a camera, and then we said, who is going to film? And Joe, who was the cook and my school friend, she said, well, I'd love to film. I'm the cooking. I don't do a watch. So we packed her off to the BBC with a camera for 4 days. 4 days. I mean, just extraordinary. And then she came back to the boat, and you know, we practiced before we went, which again is something the guys' boats didn't really do, even if they had cameras. We worked out that we needed a camera fixed on the radar mast for emergency situations when Jo couldn't film, because we needed her on the deck as a crew member. And Jo has an amazing emotional intelligence, and her connection with her subjects, which is us, is what makes this whole film so completely unique. And Alex says without her footage, he wouldn't have been able to make the documentary he made.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Tracy Edwards. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tracy Edwards spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Edwards and her all-women crew that competed in the 1989 Whitbread Round the World race are the subject of the new documentary Maiden. It's playing in theaters around the country. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.